Thank you very much. Thanks for coming, everyone. While we change the slides in the front, let me say thanks to all of you. Those of us who write and do research are dependent on a vast network of support. And I want to express a public thanks to archivists, to historians, colleagues and friends, and the editors and publishers who helped me on the journey that I'm going to be speaking with you about tonight. And I want to start out by saying something you probably have never heard at the beginning of a history lecture, which is that it's okay to laugh. As the cartoon on the screen suggests, there are some laughable moments to the story that we're going to be thinking together about tonight. Some of it is going to strike you as a little bit funny, and it is from our vantage point. Tonight we're thinking back to the years 1944 to 46, the end of the Second World War and the transition to peace. And in the midst of that transition, when of course there are many pressing issues for the world to face, we're recovering a story of a rather fantastic idea that there should be a capital of the world, a place that would be the center for diplomacy, but a place that would house the United Nations and be grander, that it might be its own identity, its own city, or at least an expansive suburb. It might be sort of like a World's Fair, or it might be like a compound of fashionable embassies. Sometimes I get the impression that people were thinking of the Emerald City from the Land of Oz as they were thinking about the capital of the world in 1945. But this is the story we're entering into. And if there were to be a capital of the world, where would it be? This was a proposition that civic boosters in American cities and towns could not resist, including Philadelphia, but also many others. No one announced a competition, least of all the United Nations, but a race began. Even before the UN officially existed, a race began to try to get the attention of the world's diplomats and to win the prize of becoming the capital of the world. It was a race of civic boosters trying to get attention for their hometowns, and it was a race of newspaper reporters who were covering the story, but in many cases often creating the story, so as to boost the campaigns for bringing the United Nations to their own localities. The race went to San Francisco, where the UN Charter was drafted. It went to London, where the UN met for the first time. It went to Mackinac Island, where the nation's governors had their conference in 1945. It went to New York, which became the base of operations for the site-searching teams who would determine the outcome. It went to potential sites, especially in the Northeast, and including Philadelphia. And while civic boosters were running their own race to win a prize that no one had announced, the world's diplomats were on their own parallel track, a more deliberative course of determining whether the balance of power would lie in Europe or in the United States, of trying to get an international organization off the ground, and of dealing with the very serious issues of transitioning from war to peace, all the while with the American civic boosters nipping at their heels. Now there are, I think, some serious substantial lessons to learn from all of this. It's about the ways that local, national, and global identities are formed. It's about the ways that ideas and time and space change as communications technology changes, as transportation technology changes. But it's also a great story, as the cartoon on the screen suggests. It's full of drama and surprise and a few comic turns along the way. As the boosters were racing onto the world stage, and as the world's diplomats were trying to negotiate local politics and the American real estate market. So, to begin at the beginning, I'm often asked why I became interested and how I became interested in this topic. And so this is a story from the archives. It begins in Philadelphia, at a time when I was researching an entirely different subject, although I came to discover it was not entirely separate. I was working in the archives of Independence National Historical Park, going through news clippings, trying to assemble the history of Independence Hall. And I came across this clipping, Philadelphia, home of the United Nations, from the front page of the Philadelphia Record in 1945. And my only response was, "What?" I had lived in Philadelphia for a while, and I thought I knew something about Philadelphia's history. But this was news to me, and I wanted to find out more. Just from a little investigation, I found that Philadelphia, in addition to San Francisco, was among the earliest and most assertive and longest-lasting competitors for the honor of becoming the host location for the United Nations. The inspiration was, as you can see somewhat in the clipping and can see more clearly now, Independence Hall, which was seen by Philadelphians as an inspiration to the nation and therefore presumed to be an inspiration to the world. What better reason could there be to locate the United Nations than to put it within the vicinity of the cradle of liberty? And I came to discover that this kind of attachment to local and national history was embedded in many of the competitors that came forward, offering themselves to be the capital of the world. That often they were acting from a basis of their local history, which they saw as contributing to the nation's history, which they saw then as having international significance. And it was especially true of places that had historic connections to the colonial era, to the American Revolution, and to founding fathers. So in addition to Philadelphia, into the race come Boston, Morristown, New Jersey, Saratoga, New York, Charlottesville, and Williamsburg, Virginia, just to name a few, on that basis. Here we see Philadelphians on the steps of Independence Hall looking forward to their future. They are holding a map of the city, and if we could see the other side of the street, we would see an aging commercial district that had yet to become Independence National Historical Park. They are imagining that future will build from the past that they have already in place. And I love this kind of gaze up and forward as if they're seeing the future. And this was true of other cities as well. In Detroit, that was another competitor where the boosters really saw the potential of the world capital as being a step forward from the city into the future. So this was intriguing. And I read a little bit in histories of the United Nations and got a little bit into the records of the early organization and saw some references that there were maybe 30 to 50 of these self-proclaimed world capital competitors. And that seemed enough to look a little farther. I came to understand, though, that there were many, many more. A greater variety, places in every region of the country, and not only large cities that you might expect, like Boston, Chicago, St. Louis, New Orleans, Denver, San Francisco, but smaller places that I never would imagine would be in a contest to become the center of the world. Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, for example, or Tuskahoma, Oklahoma. Now, clearly, I needed to find out more about this. So far as I know at this point, there were at least 248 localities that became involved in this episode to one degree or another by either making a suggestion or issuing an official invitation or embarking on a full-blown campaign to make their hometowns the capital of the world. So here I could see there would be a wide variety of materials that would allow me to see what was happening in the United States, in the society and the culture, in this transitional moment from war to peace. And it would also touch on issues that were compelling, like how we develop ideas of a place, how that is related to local identity, how that makes us feel a connection to the world. So off I was on my adventure and search for the capital of the world. Now, one of the places that I'd like to introduce into the conversation is sort of a counterpoint to the story of Philadelphia, because it is also one of the earliest and most long-lasting competitors, is the Black Hills of South Dakota. Meet Paul Bellamy. Paul Bellamy is in the driver's seat. Now, he appears in some histories of the United Nations, and he and the interest of the Black Hills are always sort of the throwaway line, right? They're the stand-in, the shorthand for expressing the ridiculous lengths that the American Booster campaign went to. However, I spent a little time in South Dakota and a little time getting to know Paul Bellamy and his campaign. And I came to have a different idea about this. And this was true for me of a lot of the campaigners that seemed just a little out there, right? Just a little wacky to be on the list for the potential capital of the world. This is Paul Bellamy in 1936. You can see he's driving FDR. And they are on their way to a dedication of one of the carvings on Mount Rushmore. Bellamy was the owner of a transportation company, so it often fell to him to drive the celebrities that came to Mount Rushmore or other sites in the region, but he also organized tours for other visitors. He was a big local booster of tourism and locally beneficial projects. He was involved in the planning for Mount Rushmore, for the highways that snake through those hills if you've ever visited there, for the Badlands National Park. He was not the major player in those projects, but he was always in them, right, and always promoting the cause of the Black Hills. So Paul Bellamy became so compelling to me that he became the opening of the book for the capital of the world. And I want to read you just a little bit so that you get a feeling for Paul Bellamy and his story and the reason why the Black Hills of South Dakota were a contender, at least so far as they were concerned. During the second week of September 1944, the United States Army Air Force delivered a telegram with tragic news to Paul and Lucy Bellamy of Rapid City, South Dakota. Just a few days short of their 40th wedding anniversary, the Bellamys learned that their younger son, Lieutenant Paul Herbert Bellamy, had died on August 26th in a mid-air collision 17,000 feet over England. Herb, 22 years old, had been the lead pilot of two groups of B-17 Flying Fortresses. In flight, Bellamy's crew observed a plane above them getting too close to their own ship. The engineer and bombardier both raced toward the cockpit, intending to grab the controls and dive the plane. But it was too late. The planes collided and exploded, and Herb and his co-pilot went down with the ship. Half a world away from the physical remains of his son, Paul Bellamy searched for channels for his grief. His thoughts raced over his son's short life, the baby, the playful boy, the teenager, the groom, the volunteer pilot in training at the airbase on the outskirts of Rapid City, perhaps a future father, perhaps a partner in business. Bellamy felt compelled to document this moment, to try to make sense of it, to do something. Immediately he sat down and composed a tribute to his son. He struggled to justify the terrible loss. Why did it take the tragedies of war to make those left behind stop and examine their priorities? How could the survivors be worthy of the sacrifices of their sons and daughters? And 2 months later, we find Paul Bellamy at the podium of his local Chamber of Commerce meeting proposing that the Black Hills issue an invitation to the United Nations to bring its headquarters there to that region. It was a memorial act to his son and to others who had died in the war. So it was not as crazy as it may seem at first blush. It's also a story that speaks to some of the themes that run through the book and this whole episode of the search for the capital of the world. And that's the generational story. The people who are pursuing this dream beyond all reason, although it seemed perfectly reasonable to them, I think of them as the parent generation of World War II. They were people who were born at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th, and by World War II, they are the civic leaders of their communities. Many of them had served in war. For Paul Bellamy, it was the Spanish-American War era. He served in the Philippines. Many others had served in the First World War, which was to be the war to end all wars. And here they were in the 1940s. Sending off their sons and daughters to another war, and often seeing the same sacrifices made by their children. So they were very committed to stopping warfare, to ensuring peace for the future, and to supporting the United Nations as a way of doing that. And this was a motivation for many of them to be involved in the race for the capital of the world. Now, in Paul Bellamy's case, he was really in the race. Here he is in San Francisco at the conference to draft the United Nations Charter, sharing a cigar and lobbying one of the delegates to the UN Charter Conference. He also made his way to London, where the UN was first organizing. He was in the halls of parliament. He was going to receptions. He saw this really as another business proposition, and that if he just kept maneuvering and chatting with people, they would see the logic of his proposal. And he was very serious about it, even though he was not always taken seriously, particularly by the news reporters who were covering this adventure. So the competition grew. The UN was in the news a lot in 1945. And with each wave of headlines came more competitors. And I put this slide back up to you in order to describe the way that this wave hits the diplomatic world in the fall of 1945. I call this chapter Blitz because I think that's about how it felt to the diplomats. The competition to become the capital of the world, which no one had announced, reached London in the fall of 1945 with a bombardment of invitations that no one had solicited. A resolution from the town board of Hyde Park, New York, a letter from the Chamber of Commerce of Beloit, Wisconsin, promotional brochures from Boston, St. Louis, Miami, and Newport, Rhode Island, petitions from Claremore, Oklahoma, and suggestions from Saratoga, Valley Forge, Monticello, and Williamsburg. Bizarre communications signed by Chase Osborne of Possum Poke in Possum Lane, somewhere in Georgia. Site plans from South Dakota and photographs from Philadelphia. Starting with a smattering of five suggested capitals in September of 1945, the proposed locations increased by 13 in October, 17 more in November, and then a torrent of 85 in December. A few suggestions arrived for locations outside the United States, but most of the correspondence came from American public officials, publishers, business leaders, and other individuals promoting their own hometowns. And the appeals became more and more elaborate. These are some examples of the promotional materials that landed in the mail in London. Philadelphia is at this point still promoting its historic significance as its main appeal. You see Chicago situating itself at the center of the planet. And on the right, what San Francisco called a brochure, but is clearly much, much more than that, is being displayed by a flight attendant who is sitting amid the crates of these that were headed off to London. So here you see the promotion being built around the promotion. So this is growing and growing and growing. Once they got to the diplomats in London, the response they received only encouraged more, because diplomats are diplomatic. No one said no. No one said go away. The response was, your materials will be considered by the appropriate parties at the appropriate time. If you're a civic booster, what does that sound like to you? Yes, you're still in the running. You know, try harder. And I think this was part of the spirit of Americans at this time. Having helped the Allies win the war, that anything, they could accomplish anything if only they tried hard enough. And so no one was giving up. Even those such as the people from the Black Hills who really never stood a chance. They didn't know that because no one said no. And they were in the game all the way. If there was to be a capital of the world, what might it look like? So not only did we have civic boosters producing brochures, we had architects devising plans for what the United Nations might become. This was the first plan created in San Francisco at the time of the conference there. And this is from a newspaper, so it is not very easy to see. But this plan reminds me a little bit of the Trilon and Perisphere from the 1939 World's Fair. And I think many of these plans reflect that sensibility of world's fairs, either through their design or through their architects who had connections with world's fairs, or through their setting. Some of them were literally on sites of world's fairs. The other thing I see in these plans, I'm going to show you two or three more of them, is a developing idea that a city, an existing place, might not be the best location for a new world peace organization. That maybe it should be its own place. Maybe it needs a more pastoral setting in order to do the work of peace. Here is a second design for San Francisco. This is actually in Marin County on the bay. And here you see this is on the waterfront with sort of the space age sort of design there. I think these are all visions of the future. You know, what will the post-war world be like? This is Chicago. This is Northerly Isle, which is a little peninsula very near the downtown. And what you're seeing here is the proposal for the world capital built on Northerly Isle. What I find interesting about this is you really can't see Chicago. Right? It's as if the city is not there. Right? So there's an idea here that the peace organization needs to be in more peaceful surroundings. Often there are proposals for islands. This is from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. There's a very similar design for Niagara Falls. These were border proposals that joined the towns on both sides of the border. So Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and the twin town in Canada, and the same with Niagara Falls. Modern buildings, symbolic traffic circles, right, linking roads from both continents are part of these designs. And finally, back to our friends in South Dakota. This is the design for the world capital in the Black Hills. This would have been in a valley in the Black Hills. And what you're seeing here is a central tower structure. And this, it looks like concentric circles, but it's actually a spiral to allow the United Nations to grow and grow and grow in perpetuity. And here you see small office structures for the delegations, which look to me a little bit like suburban cul-de-sac developments. In the hills, there would have been villages for nationalities. And straight through the middle is the World Highway, the highway that would allow you to drive around the world, which of course would go straight through South Dakota. So this was their proposal for the Black Hills. The Philadelphians did not create an architectural design. Part of their pitch was, we're not going to tell you what to do, right? Just please come here. They did recognize that the idea of the city as a location was falling out of favor, and they needed to change the idea of putting it close to Independence Hall, even though they did intend to create that expansive plaza there. And so they moved, as Charles said earlier, their aspirations to Belmont Plateau, and this is a current picture of Belmont Plateau, which now I'm calling the Field of Dreams because it's all baseball diamonds out there now, as you see, and you can see the city skyline in the background there, and you can barely see Memorial Hall from the 1876 World's Fair, also is visible from this location. So they proposed this location as well as additional acreage in Northwest Philadelphia and into Montgomery County in order to put together as much acreage as they could to try to entice the United Nations to come to Philadelphia. So here's a question. If you're going to put the capital of the world somewhere, how do you decide where the center is in 1945? Among the diplomats, the debate was really between Europe and the United States. Would the United Nations be in the traditional center for diplomacy, or would it move to the United States to make a fresh start? But the idea of center is a very transitional sort of concept at this time. Ideas of time and space were being transformed by transportation, by communications technology. The world was coming closer together, but not everyone was thinking of it that way yet. And so there's some very interesting discussions where people are talking about distance. Some people talk about it in terms of miles, but other people talk about it in terms of hours. And the hours distance was changing. Commercial aviation was about to take off. And for that reason, any place could make the argument that when they got their fabulous new airport, they were going to be the center of the world. And they could very easily accommodate the United Nations. They make this point with maps, as you see here. This is the Black Hills campaign, and you see the concentric circles moving outward, and you see the airplanes coming in from each continent. No problem, everyone can get to Rapid City. Here is a similar promotion from Atlantic City, which was very assertive in the competition as well, and you see them connecting everywhere. Here is the St. Louis promotion. Weldon Spring was the site outside of the city that they were putting forward. And here's Tuskahoma, Oklahoma. Again, with the concentric circles there at the center, and they're offering this very modern structure, and the airplane is arriving to bring the world to Tuskahoma. And you can see here that they're measuring air miles, right, in order to show how accessible Tuskahoma might be. Now, Tuskahoma is another one of those stories that on first glance seems like one of the crazy places on the list. But there's also a richer story behind it. Some of you may know that Tuskahoma was the capital of the Choctaw Nation. And it was proposed to the UN as a place where the diplomats could locate and make a statement about social justice by being in the land of an oppressed people. And so there's much more going on to the Tuskahoma campaign than might appear. So there are all these promotions about air travel, how easy it will be, how swift it will be to travel to any location that might want to be the capital of the world. But then there's a wrinkle. Boosters were boasting about this, as boosters will, but in the fall of 1945, there were 16 groups of boosters that decided they really had to go to London in person in order to make their pitch. Here are the Philadelphians on the airplane, getting ready to go make their appeal to the United Nations. And one of the reasons we know about their trip is they kept a very detailed journal. It's now in the digital collections at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, so I encourage you to go online and take a look, because it is really a fabulous description. But what I learned from the journal is that it was really hard to travel from Philadelphia to London in 1945. First of all, they may be sitting on an airplane getting ready to leave, but they are not in Philadelphia. They are in New York. You could not get on an airplane in Philadelphia, right, and fly in 1945. That would come along pretty soon for Philadelphia. But they had to take a train to New York and then wait for the weather to be right in order to get on the airplane. And day after day, they would just wait for a phone call to tell them whether the plane could go. And sometimes they would get a phone call that, yes, they could go, and then 3 minutes later, they would say it would be called off. At one point, one of them tried to book passage on the Queen Mary, thinking it would be faster to get to London than it would be to take the plane. But they did finally fly. So did the mayor of Chicago, so did the governor of Massachusetts, and each one of them is a tale of adventure and difficulty and long, long journeys to get to London. So they were going to have a little bit of a hard time making that case about transportation. But enough of them did get there that they forced the UN to have hearings, pretty much just to make them all go away, right? Someone had to listen to them. It was a formality. The diplomats, for their part, narrowed down the field fairly quickly. And it was a matter of geography. If the United Nations were not going to be in Europe, the Europeans were determined that it should be as close as possible. And that meant in the Northeast. They also determined that they wanted to be close enough to a major city in order to enjoy the cultural amenities and to have access to universities and healthcare and those sorts of services. But they did not want to be so close that they would be subsumed into a metropolis. They were still thinking of the capital of the world, vast amounts of land that would be their own. And what you're seeing here are two concentric circles, one around Boston. Okay, so they decided to look within this radius of Boston and within this radius of New York. Okay, so this is 80 miles out from New York. a line which was drawn in order to include Hyde Park, the home of Franklin Roosevelt. But you notice there's another circle here, 25 miles. They didn't want to be any closer to New York City than 25 miles. Absolutely not. The conversation in the committee was three sentences, right? No. Yeah, we're not going any closer. The New Yorkers were pushing very hard for Flushing Meadow, Queens, the site of the World's Fair in 1939. Now, it looks like Philadelphia is in the loop, right? Wrong. The Philadelphians were shocked to discover that when the list came out of places to be toured, they were not on it. And the reason they were not on it is that they were considered to be too close to Washington, D.C. The diplomats did not want the United Nations to be within the influential realm of a national capital. Now, Philadelphians never thought of themselves as being close to Washington, D.C. We still don't, right? But they didn't take it very well when when they got this news from the United Nations. This says, "Hello, Mom, we was robbed." And here's our colonial figure of Philadelphia again, being unfairly treated, or so they thought, by the United Nations. But I have to tell you that all was not lost. It was not lost, and I'm going to go back to the map for a moment in order to explain this, because as the diplomats looked for sites, and they went to the sites where the numbers are here, they did find a place that they liked. But of all the hundreds of communities that wanted to become the capital of the world, they chose one of the few locations in the nation that wanted to have nothing to do with it. They chose initially a site in Fairfield County, Connecticut, involving parts of Greenwich and parts of Stamford. Stamford had wanted to invite the UN, and they did, but nobody asked the people of Greenwich. The United Nations encountered so much resistance in the suburbs north of New York, first in that particular location and then in the two adjoining counties north of New York, that they had to go shopping again. And they went looking around at some longtime contenders. They visited San Francisco finally, for the first time since the Charter Conference had been there. They went back to Boston, and they came to Philadelphia. They came to look at that great site on Belmont Plateau. And this was very appealing. Philadelphia had a great site. It was good for construction, and it was available for free. It was easy commuting. I mean, even today, you can get from Center City, Philadelphia, to Belmont Plateau in about 10 minutes if you're having a good day on the expressway. I know, that's a factor. Philadelphia had cultural amenities. They were treated to lunch at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Everyone seemed to love them. It was such a contrast to what they were experiencing in the suburbs of New York. By the time this additional tour was finished, Philadelphia was the leading contender, the favored choice. A vote was imminent. So when I asked the question, how close did Philadelphia come to becoming the capital of the world? The answer is pretty darn close. There were headlines in the New York Times, but New Yorkers were alert to the risk. And of course, New Yorkers had their own booster committee. And by this point, the New Yorkers, led by Robert Moses and Nelson Rockefeller, had enticed the UN to a temporary meeting place at Flushing Meadow, right? The site where they wanted the United Nations to be. When this prospect of Philadelphia seemed to be almost certain, a phone call went out to Nelson Rockefeller. And I think if you know any part of this story, it's probably the end. And that's the other fun part about tracing this out, is we do know the end. We just don't know how we got there. But Nelson Rockefeller came back from a vacation, and there was quick huddling and discussion about what New York could do. And the story that you probably know is that John D. Rockefeller Jr., who is Nelson's father, made a gift of $8.5 million to purchase a site in Midtown Manhattan, which at that point was a slaughterhouse district. It had been parceled together by a real estate developer with the idea of building something new along the lines of Rockefeller Center. So it was put together, there was option on the property, and John D. Rockefeller made the gift. And because of that, that site is now the United Nations headquarters. It's maybe not the capital of the world of everyone's dreams. The planner who supervised the architectural work here referred to it as a workshop for peace. So it's not so grand. It's a more workaday sort of place. And just to conclude, I want to read just a little, because I think it projects my feeling of how this story is. It's the story of the end of World War II and the beginning of peace. It's a panorama of that era, but I think it also touches really deeply into some chords in American culture. Because today, capital of the world survives as a slogan for New York City rather than a place of dreams. As reporters noted while trailing UN diplomats through darkness in Connecticut on one of their site tours, the search for the capital of the world could have been a movie. The reporters said that it could have been a movie. Or perhaps it should have inspired a Broadway show. With tap dancing civic boosters, diplomats step kicking in circles, and choruses of anything you can do, I can do better. I left my heart in San Francisco and Oklahoma. For the grand finale, diplomats and boosters could dedicate the United Nations headquarters in New York with a rounding rendition of Accentuate the Positive from the 1944 film Here Come the Waves. Looking back, if it all seems a little bit crazy, then we've lost touch with the atmosphere of determination, hope, and anxiety that characterized American society at the end of the Second World War. We've forgotten the time when people in cities and towns across the United States imagined themselves on the world stage, and not just on the stage, but at its center as the stars of the show. Thank you very much.